Thank you again for being here. And once again, my name is Elizabeth Baker Keffer. I'm publisher of The Atlantic, and we are co-hosting and co-sponsoring the festival with the Aspen Institute. Today's session is actually part of our arts and culture track, which is being sponsored by Altria. So we want to give a special thanks to them. They have underwritten a festival track for 2 years in a row and have helped to make this programming possible. So we're very appreciative to Altria for doing this for us. Today's topic is reading and democracy. What's at stake? And reading and democracy, to me, are two themes and two issues that are at the center of the Atlantic and have been now for 150 years. This is our 150th anniversary this November, and we've been writing about these themes for that century and a half. In fact, our readers are real readers. They're avid book readers. They're avid readers of our magazine. Our magazine has the single longest reading time of any national magazine. So our readers are readers. And democracy is a topic and theme that we've been covering since 1857. Our roots were in the abolition movement. We had Nathaniel Hawthorne do reporting from the Civil War battlefield and up to today with reporting from Iraq. So we are keenly interested in that topic as well. And here today to talk about the link between those issues is Dana Gioia, who is the ninth chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He is a poet, a critic, an educator, and a former business executive. And as I only learned today, we helped to put him on the map. In part, he published a piece within The Atlantic in 1991 called Can Poetry Matter? And as I hear from Dana, that was one of the most widely read pieces and the one that garnered the single most letters to the editor of anything that we've done. And Dana has gone on to write books, including a book on that topic, Can Poetry Matter? Essays on Poetry in American Culture. And he's also written Disappearing Ink, Poetry at the End of Print Culture. He's also written two opera libretti, and he has been a translator of poetry from Latin, Italian, German, and Romanian. He, in 2001, founded the Teaching Poetry Conference, focusing on how to improve the teaching of poetry in high schools. And he's the founder and co-director of the Westchester University Poetry Conference, which is the nation's largest annual writing conference strictly dedicated to poetry. So we're thrilled to have you here today, and I'll pass things over to you. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm going to try to make this session very substantial, but also very informal. So let me begin by introducing myself in a different sort of way. I'm a working class kid from L.A. My dad, when I was born, was a cab driver. My mom worked behind the counter of a Rexall drugstore, and then was a phone operator. My dad was Sicilian, my mom was Mexican, and I was raised mostly in L.A., working class L.A., by people who didn't speak English as their native language, and I had a huge pool of Sicilian relations. I became the first person in my family to go to college. There's a line that occurs in a lot of personal narratives where when somebody says, I realized at an early age I was different from the other boys. I'm not going to use it in its conventional sense, but I realized from an early age I was different from the other boys because I would hear music and it would just ravish me. You know, I would hear my mother recite poetry and I would just love it. I would see a painting and it would just stop me in my tracks. And I knew fairly early on that I wanted to hang around the arts. I didn't really know in what capacity. And it wasn't also anything that had, there were any available models in my community. And so I began to get involved in the only art that, for the most part, is available to poor people, which is music. And I went to Catholic school. I had Sister Camille Cecile, who taught me piano lessons. And she was one of the old school that believed that corporeal punishment and music were inseparable. Perhaps you've had music teachers like this. But she, suddenly in fourth and fifth grade, she's having me play Mozart and Bartok. And this was enormously liberating to me. By the time I went to high school, I really thought I wanted to be a composer, and I was writing music and listening to music. I became the first member of my family to go to college. I went to Stanford on a scholarship, and there I sort of switched from music into literature, and I realized after a while I wanted to be a poet. And I had a problem, which not everybody perhaps in this room does, which is my parents neglected to give me the private income I so richly deserved. And so I had to find, you know, a way of making a living. And first I thought I would be a professor, and I went off to a little school in Cambridge, Massachusetts for graduate school. But after a couple of years at Harvard with great teachers and a great program, I realized that I wasn't being trained to be a writer in the sense that we think of writers. I was being trained beautifully, meticulously well to speak a kind of Mandarin language of literary theory that was known to about 700 people in North America. And I felt that what a writer should do is have an ability, let's say like Shakespeare did, to speak to every member of his audience. And I certainly didn't want to be trained to be a writer in a way which could not be understood by the very people I came from. And so at that point, I did something which I think I can say I'm the only person in human history who went to Stanford Business School to be a poet. And I went, I got an MBA, and I made myself a promise that I would write or read for 3 hours every day. And so at Stanford, I met my wife, Mary, who is sitting here, who helped get me through many a final. And we then I went off to New York, where I was in business for the next 15 years. I wrote at night, wrote on weekends, and worked for General Foods for 15 years. And then in the early 90s, I quit and I became a full-time writer. And I was a full-time writer for about 13 years until I became chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. And as a writer, I was a music critic for San Francisco Magazine. I started writers' conferences. I wrote for the BBC. And so when I came to the National Endowment for the Arts, I realized that without ever intending to, you know, I had done all the career development, you know, for something like that. And I brought a perspective as a working artist, as a kid whom the arts had been decisive in a sense of saving me from the fate of most of the kids I grew up with, which was really not to go to college and in most cases just really have a kind of a fairly low-level job. I'd seen, in a sense, how ideas and things were coordinated in corporate America, but I'd also stood outside of organizations as an independent artist and to see what the human needs, the human purposes of the arts are. Now, just before I was chairman, I happened to be writing something, which is actually Disappearing Ink, which was the essay in the book that was mentioned in the introduction. And I used a survey that was really quite unique. It was done by the National Endowment for the Arts. At this point, I had no notion that I would ever end up in this organization. And so I was very familiar with this survey they did. And now, I want to tell you a story. I'm in the National Endowment for the Arts as a chairman, and we're looking at this next survey that we're doing. And so I asked them to add some extra questions about reading and literature, because every 10 years, the NEA does a survey, and you've got some of the results on these little brochures that are on your table, which is unique in the world. We go into 17,000 American homes that have been chosen to replicate the U.S. population according to the census of the previous year. We interview these people about all of their arts and civic activities. So we do everything from whether they read poetry, to whether they've seen modern dance, to whether they go to a ball game, to whether they volunteer for the church bazaar, et cetera, et cetera. And so our survey is about 20 times the size of a New York Times survey, you know, or an Associated Press survey. And it is really an in-depth survey about people's activities. When this data came in, and we were about to put our normal report together, we discovered something that was really quite shocking to us, which was that every group of Americans, every age group, income group, educational level, race, region, and both genders, were reading less than they read 10 years before, and dramatically less than they read 20 years before. All of the gains that we had seen in certain areas of society, like African-American reading, were not only lost, but brought down to a level below, you know, where they had been 20 years ago. And we began to see something else. Because we were looking at people's broader activities, we began to make a connection, which I think probably most people in this room have thought about in the back of their heads, but we were able to statistically demonstrate this, that this drop in reading was not really just a literary problem, not just really a cultural problem, but was actually a fundamental social, economic, and political problem. And let me explain what I mean. But I'm going to just give you a global overview, and then I'll give you the pieces. We live in a country today in which fewer people read, and most people read less. The younger you are, the more likely this is to be true. Because people read less, because fewer people read, people therefore read less well. Because they read less well, they do less well in school. Because they read less well, we now live in a country in which 30% of kids drop out of high school. This, to me, is a national disgrace. But you never hear it mentioned in national discourse. 30% of kids drop out of high school. We have this generation that reads less, that reads less well, that has lower levels of academic completion. Guess what? They do less well in the job market. Every business in the United States is now dealing with this. If you look at a survey of American businesses of what are the major problems they experience with new hires, two of the top three problems are about not being able to write well, not being able to read well. These were not even problems in these surveys 20, 30 years ago. They are now the major problem. By one estimate, American industry spends, I'm not making this number up, spends $5 billion in remedial programs trying to make up for what's not happening in education or what's not happening in society. Gets worse. Because people read less, they are less active in their communities. They volunteer less, they go out less, they become involved in the political process less. So we're seeing right now, and this is, if you remember nothing else, this is what you should remember. We're seeing right now the United States behaviorally divide into two groups of people. One group shops, works, comes home, and spends most of their time with electronic entertainment. They watch TV, then they go to the internet, then they play a video game, and as they're walking from the video game back to the computer, they're instant messaging on their phones or listening to their iPod. And you even see something in American households right now where you might have a family in which each member is alone in a room engaged in some kind of form of electronic entertainment or communication. So it's not only operating on a social level with communities, it's operating even in the fundamental building block of society, which is the family. The other group of Americans, now this is interesting, they do everything the first group does. You know, they play video games, they watch TV, they have their iPods instead of the other, but they balance it with other activities, which means, in very shorthand, is they get out of the house to do something other than shop or go to work. They do volunteer work, they do charity work, they play sports, they volunteer to coach sports, they belong to amateur teams, they go to the theater, they go to the museums, they go to other performing arts. They do this at a level of 300 to 400% higher than the first group. Now, if you wanted to say, how do I tell if somebody's in one group or another? I can only test one factor. What do you think the leading, I don't know if it's causal, although I do believe that, but correlative factor is whether or not they read for pleasure. The people who read are overwhelmingly different in every aspect of their personal and civic behavior. Every kind of personal or civic positive activity we can measure, they are at a much higher level. I'll give you a counterintuitive thing. Would you believe that people who read exercise more than people who don't read? They do at a huge level. Now, when I first saw this data, I said, there's something wrong with this data. You know, that we're screening something else. It's income that's coming through. So we ran the data taking income out analyzing things for income. The poorest group of Americans who read do volunteer and charity work at 200 to 300% of the level of the richest group of Americans who don't read. These are overwhelmingly huge differences in income. So what is going on? There's no easy statistical way to measure causality, but I think common sense tells us something, that when you read, if you develop a habit of reading, two things seem to be happening to you as an individual. First of all, you know, we tend to have reading in our society characterized as a passive activity. It's actually not passive. You used focused linear attention, you use your imagination, you use your memory. And reading, first of all, awakens in the person a heightened sense of themselves as an individual. It's a far more active thing than watching television, where the images, the pacing, the background music, the emotional impact, everything is given to you, and you receive it more or less passively. Now, most Americans assert their active impulse by making snide comments at the screen. But I don't think that's quite as awakening intellectually as reading a book. But the other thing that a book does, and this is something that I think is extraordinarily important when you look at the history of free societies, because what we think of as liberal democracy emerged first in countries which had high levels of daily reading, countries like England, in which a significant portion of the people engaged in a daily meditation about the lives of other people from the inside. The primary form of this meditation is called the novel, where you read about somebody's daily life from the inside their own sensibility. It could be a man named Robinson Crusoe who's stranded on an island and has to reinvent every aspect of his life. It could be a young girl who doesn't have a dowry, who's forced to work as a servant and fend off the sexual advances of her boss, which is two of the most famous early novels are written about that. It can be a kid whose parents are wiped out, named David Copperfield, who's forced to work in a blacking factory making polish. And people had this daily meditation which about the life of someone unlike themselves, usually less fortunate than themselves. And out of this collective daily meditation across the country of largely the educated or the rising classes created a sense of social responsibility, of human compassion, a sense of the ill as well as the positive effects of power that would never have come out of a society which did not have this. The same thing happens in the United States today, which is the second thing that reading does, is it tends to create a heightened sense of the reality of other people's lives, which is to say, a sense of awareness and responsibility for the community in which you live. If we lose these things, we lose the driving engine of democracy, which is public civic participation. A democracy is healthier in which 80% of the people participate versus 20% of the people participate. So the NEA began to look at this data, and we felt that we had to make an issue out of it. I've put two reports on your tables, and there should be enough copies for everyone. These are just the summaries. We tried to do a summary that was so simple that even a U.S. senator could understand, which is to say a very busy person with many, many distractions could pick up, and we just, in 10 points, we summarize the data. Now, if you want to see the data in its completeness, we can provide you with a full report, or you could even download it on the internet from the NEA website. What we then did is to begin to in the second report, which is called Arts and Civic Participation, begin to correlate it with a lot of the civic data that we have. And you'll start to see that by every measure, a community in which people read is a healthier community. Now, we're about to issue a third report, and this is a rather interesting one, where we decided to take everything the federal government knew about reading, because there are dozens of huge reports, but the federal government being the federal government, nobody talks to anybody else. You do your report, you issue it, you don't read anybody else's report. So for about 2 years, we've gathered every study, everything from the Bureau of Labor Statistics to the Department of Education, and we've now essentially can track the whole process, you know, from the elementary, you know, grades of education up through the job market, even to things like criminal incarcerations, relationship to illiteracy, lack of academic completion, et cetera, et cetera. And we will be issuing this report in the fall. But what you'll see is that if we want, in a sense, to sustain the health of a democracy, and we can only choose one pressure point, that reading, lifelong reading, active, engaged literacy is the single most responsive point. Now, there is no one solution to this, but let me give you another story as you go through here. We're actually rather good in America today at teaching a young kid to read. If you look at the way that the elementary education in the U.S. has been reformed and revised, I would say here, talking really, you know, kindergarten through about sixth grade, the scores are going up, the participation in society is growing up. Almost every group of American kids, every race, every region, seems to be performing a little bit better than they did. We seem to have learned a lot about this. The trouble is, when kids hit adolescence, everything else in society outside of the classroom tells them reading's not important. Gives them lots and lots of other things. And we start to see in adolescence this thing fall off. Guess who it falls off more decisively with, boys or girls? Boys. You know, so as in so many other things in society, the problems, rest more with the men than the women. Lower levels of academic completion, higher levels of incarceration, lower levels of reading, lower reading skills, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That problem is getting worse and worse, and you can actually, you know, connect it with almost every other social problem that you find in terms of this. So you start to look at this thing, and it somehow in adolescence, and anybody who has a teenager at home knows this, the culture begins to take over, and these kids become increasingly captives of commercial electronic mass entertainment, spending less and less time with their schoolwork, and actually, interesting, less and less time with other human beings, not just their family. It's not just their father and their mother they're cut off with, but increasingly, it's easier for them to relate to a video game, to a video, to a website than to other people. They exercise less, they go out less, and they don't develop the kind of complicated social skills that a teenager needs to succeed in society. Our school system seems largely unable to deal with this issue, and that's a whole other discussion I don't really want to get into right now. Now, what can we do? Well, we can do lots and lots of stuff. The NEA decided that we would try to do one national program of the highest quality and the broadest democratic reach, not because we believe that this one program could in and of itself change society, but that we could, in a sense, provide an example of how other programs might work with us and together change it. So, and also to show that even this is kind of like the little engine that could, even a tiny federal agency like the NEA could think ambitiously, and by doing that, bring in hundreds and indeed thousands of partners to work together. Now, we did a lot of studying. We looked at a bunch of programs, and finally we recognized that the best idea that we sought was a grassroots idea, which is usually called the community read. It was first developed in Seattle about 12 years ago by a librarian named Nancy Pearl, and she got the idea that if she could get all of Seattle to read the same novel, that you'd, in a sense, create a situation where you had a positive social reinforcement for reading, and that one of the things people would have in common is a book. And so we looked at this. It had been tried by about 200 cities. The cities loved it, but lots of communities, especially poorer ones or smaller ones, had trouble sustaining the idea because they didn't have the resources inside their own community to be able to do it. Plus, even the larger ones, and like Chicago has a beautifully run program, I think called Chicago Reads, that they didn't have the resources to be able to compete with electronic entertainment sort of on an equal footing. So what we did was to create a program called The Big Read. We borrowed the name, with permission, from, I think, Schenectady, New York, which had called their program this. And we began to pilot this in 10 cities. And what we do is that we develop material based on great novels, and we have a selection here, and you can help yourself to these. I mean, the first four books we did were Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God, and F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. We've gone on to include books by Hemingway, Amy Tan, John Steinbeck, Willa Cather, Edith Wharton, Carson McCullers, Rudolfo Anaya, and actually the 12th book we did is The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett, because we want to make say that it's okay to read the best of any kind of book, detective stories, science fiction, historical novels, coming-of-age novels. And we would take a community, and we would ask the community to apply to us as a group. So we want the library, the mayor's office, the chamber of commerce, the school district, and then the local media, the newspaper, the radio station, the TV station. And we're able to get about 150 to 200 partners in a community, and get people from about 15 to 95 involved, and in a month have maybe 200 events. We tried this in 10 cities with our partners at Arts Midwest and the Institute of Museum and Library Services. We're now in 200 cities, and next year we will be in about 400 to 425 cities across all 50 states, and I hope to be in every congressional district in the United States to involve tens of millions of people in this. Ideally, what you have is a situation where a teenager in high school is reading a book and that one or both of his or her parents or grandparents are reading the books. Each of the classes do projects. They may bring the projects into a retirement community, into a library, and you actually have the community meet itself, meet one another through a book. If we're doing Fahrenheit 451, we do events in fire stations. I mean, when's the last time you saw the fire department sponsor a literary event? They actually like the idea. We'll get a business like a Starbucks or a Krispy Kreme to stay open all night. Anybody who walks in with a book gets free coffee and donuts, and then they read the book aloud all night. It only appeals to the night owls, but our model is not the Nuremberg Rally. We don't want to march a community into a great amphitheater and have them salute F. Scott Fitzgerald. What we want to do is to have every organization within a community talk to their own people. It can be a church book club. It can be a university, and we have maybe 200 events, and even restaurants like in Oak Park for Hemingway, they're going to be cooking Hemingway menus, the meals that are featured in Hemingway novels. The wine store has the wines of Hemingway, two each according to his needs, from each according to their abilities. And so we've launched this, and we look on it as an example of what America should be doing to support reading. And we'll also have a national daily radio show in which we discuss the novels and read the novels out loud, as well as a national library distribution of all of the CDs that we're doing of sort of these audio guides to the books. So that's really the introduction that I had. So let's now have a conversation about reading, about democracy, about literature, or anything else that you have. I have to be very respectful to this audience because I notice that you all have soft fruit on your plates. If you don't like me, I'll have to duck. You have a question. I think we need to have a microphone with a question. So this lady here and the fellow will bring the microphone over. And introduce yourself and tell me where you're from, too, because I think it's kind of fun for people to know how national this audience is.
Dumbing down their newspapers to try and reach a broader audience. Would you please comment?
Yeah, well, what you're talking about is a indisputable fact. The history of American literature and the history of American journalism are the same story. I mean, they've really been deeply entwined in this country from the beginning. The free press is really one of the things that's created American literature. We're in a country right now where less than half of the population reads a daily newspaper. And the younger you are, the less likely you are to read a paper. Now, on top of that, our local papers are increasingly being replaced by national papers or nationally owned chains or syndicates of publishing things. So in a small town, you may read simply the same things somebody else is reading 3,000 miles away. And so I think you're in a situation where, in a sense, the diversity of democracy, and part of the most important diversity of democracy is locality, regionality, because the world looks different depending on where you are. And this is enormously important, I think, in terms of getting in-depth local reporting about current issues. So I agree, and I think that, you know, one of the things, and you could easily have a big read newspaper program, but you'd have to get the National Endowment for Journalism to do that. Sir? Yes.
Did you do any correlations between the changes in the family unit over the last 25 years and
reading? Well, in terms of, I mean, we know the average family size and things like that, so, but we don't have it. But one thing that is interesting is if you look at the data, both our data and other data, what are the two most likely stated causes that people claim who are readers? Why are they readers? Number one is sort of self-evident. Their parents or their grandparents read to them. The second one is much more interesting. It's their parents or grandparents didn't read to them but said, you know, get out of here, I'm reading. You know, they saw their parents or grandparents reading, you know, and you didn't even have to involve them. And it says two things that are really important. One is that a lot of behaviors are family traditions. I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say they're genetic, but you sort of do the things that your family does, that you see done. And when you have a family in which people are watching TV or just vegging out, not surprising that the kids are going to do it too. But more important, and this is something people really have to think about, the thing that infuriates me more than anything else I see in all of the many discussions of American literacy are adults who don't read chiding children who don't. We have to model the behavior we want our kids and our grandkids to have, you know, and otherwise it's just hypocrisy. And the problem is that we aren't modeling the right behavior in this regard and so many others.
How can a town become involved in the Big Read or Community Read program? What do we actually have to do?
Well, like everything else at the NEA, our programs are done through open competition. Just go on to the NEA website, just look under bigread.org or neabigread.org, and you'll see the application processes. We have two application periods each year, and let me say this. We want a community to have a successful application. You know, we want the vast majority of communities who apply for this program to be given the grant. And what the grant consists of is we size it to the size of a community. And we've had communities as small as 1,300 and as large as 5 million. So, you know, we want, and a community, we don't tell a community what a community is. You define yourself. So you may say, I want to do Aspen and Snowmass. Or you might say, we hate the people in Snowmass and we just want to do Aspen. Or we want to do all of these different towns. You might get a partnership with several towns. It's whatever you bring to us as your community. What we provide is a grant, which you have to match. We provide free television programming, radio programming, reader's guides, a beautiful full-color book and about the author that's free to every library patron, every school kid, bookstore patron, educational materials for classrooms, organizing guides, and lots of assistance in terms of bringing speakers and people like that here. And so we are eager. We want to be in every corner of the United States. I want to have a situation, actually, where I'm turning away qualified applicants so I can go to Congress and explain to them how great the need is. Congress understands this. There's three budgets in Washington right now. The president's budget, the Senate budget, and the House budget, all three budgets fund a national expansion of this program. People understand why it's important, but I think we have to create a kind of wave of national interest. So we would welcome an application from Aspen and any other community in the United States. Okay.
Dana, my name is John Carey. I'm from San Francisco, California. I was curious what you believe is the role of the library, both school libraries and public libraries, in literacy in this country.
Well, the library is an extraordinarily important institution in the United States because it, for many communities, it is the only cultural institution. I was raised in Hawthorne, California, a town you might recognize as providing the settings for Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown. Those movies capture the charm of my city. But we had a great library. No other cultural institutions at all, but going to the library after school each day, I was able to learn about all kinds of things that would have been inaccessible to me elsewhere. And we still have a system now in which almost every town, municipality, neighborhood in the United States has a library. So it is for a democratic, public, universally accessible program, a foundational partner. The trouble is most libraries and most librarians don't have the resources and training to be able to bring a process, you know, like this to fruition. So one of the ambitions of the Big Read, and this is, I think, one of the reasons why the Institute of Museum and Library Services and other federal agencies are partners, is that we want to train libraries and librarians to develop the skills they will need in the 21st century to ensure universal literacy, to ensure active adult literacy. But they need to do it in such a way where they can, but since they are a municipal organization, they know the mayor, they know the school districts, and to develop those partnerships, because in order for this to work, you really need hundreds and thousands of people involved in it. But the libraries are our chief partners. And that would be most of the places that originate the grant is either originated by a library or a local literary organization working in partnership with the library. Yes?
Hi, Susan Thomas from Aspen, Colorado. I have a question regarding what your studies of reading found in regard to the impact of books over the internet and books on tape.
Okay, I adore books on tape. You know, whenever I take a long drive, I love to have one along. What we discovered on books on tape is that if you take the 100 people who listen to books on tape, all 100 of them read elsewhere, unless they're visually impaired. You know, you'll have maybe 1-2% of people that have a visual problem or whatever, so this becomes substituted. But books on tape are for people like you and me who are probably book junkies. You know, you don't even want to take a car trip without reading a book. Books on the internet, what people that run the internet will tell you, although they don't try to go too public on this, but if you push them, no one reads on the internet. After about 14 consecutive words, you begin to sort of phase out. Now, that is not the same as saying people don't learn from the internet, because but the learning on the internet doesn't tend to be linear. It tends to be kind of associational. You see this part, you just even the way that a computer screen is used, where they have all these different pictures and things like that, people tend to learn in a more of an associative, non-linear way. If somebody wants to read something on the internet, they tend to print it out. And so it's a great informational, I mean, it's the most powerful informational tool probably ever invented, but it, in many ways, it trains people to process information in a non-linear fashion. That's terrific for some kinds of information, but it is a difficult thing to support reading or certain other linear things like mathematics or music.
Yes. My name is Chris Hutchins. I'm from Denver, Colorado, and I'm a reading consultant. And what I so agree with you when you say that reading awakens the sense of the individual, and we see the reading scores drop off for our young men, but our tests nationally across the nation break reading down into small segments, and in reaction to those tests, to get them ready for these tests, our educators resort to these small segments of reading blocks so that they never get into a good deep read. What do you say about that?
Well, there's a lot of things to talk about how reading is badly taught. I mean, it's a vast desert. And let me just say one thing, was that when I'm always interested in saying, if somebody gives me a measurement, I'd love to see the survey or the test by which the measurement was developed. And one of the things that we have in the United States right now is it's called a complex reading test, where you're given a complex text. I saw what they defined as a complex text. It's a level somewhere below USA Today. It's extraordinarily simple. And the fact that most American teenagers had a problem with a text this simple was sobering. Because what they consider a complex text is where two different opinions are given. So you'll say, I think the sky is blue, and Joe thinks the sky is red. But with this, and the end of it will say, does everybody agree on the color of the sky? You know, yes or no. And these are the tests people can't pass. I mean, it's really rather scary. But I think another problem are the books that they have kids read, which are overwhelmingly god-awful books. I mean, and especially for boys. I mean, I have two boys, and almost every book that they've been given everywhere in their education is a book about somebody coming with a particular problem into a group of people and how we all got together and sorted out our differences to come to a new and deeper understanding of our, you know, humanity. And so, and I just see my kids, their eyes glaze over. Boys like adventure. Boys, you know, like action. They like something that they can, in a sense, project themselves in a wish fulfillment. If you insist on giving boys books, which every test on young boys' reading and imagination demonstrates they don't like, guess what? They're going to say, reading's for girls. And we have a society which has basically said that. And so, you know, so I think that the way reading is taught in terms of so many ways, you know, is really, really quite bad. I mean, that's why, you know, Harry Potter, I think, was such a phenomenon. It was actually a book kids liked to read. But the trouble is you need about one Harry Potter every month to keep kids reading. And you've got to acknowledge, you've got to, in a sense, give kids pleasure. Pleasure is a great guide. You know, pleasure brings you into things that you wouldn't go into otherwise. And when you make reading dutiful and boring and moralistic, you're going to lose people.
Susanna Tomescu, Tiburon, California. It's said if you can't beat them, join them. And the essence of jiu-jitsu is to take the energy of your opponent and use it against him, or at least co-opt him. Have you seen any of the new technologies used effectively to promote reading? Or heard any interesting ideas along this line?
I'm sure they are, but the fact is that the net impact is overwhelmingly negative. You know, I mean, it's, you know, let's say you walk into a building, you know, and there are, you know, 98 drunks, cutthroats, and scoundrels in it, and two saints. You still wouldn't advise your kid to you know, go into it. And so I think the internet, electronic entertainment, are great. They're fun. They're involving. People should do them. but that we've got to somehow instill a sense of balance. And if you have a kid who becomes kind of addicted to these, and I think addiction is not too strong of a word for some of these things, you've got to find a way of tempering it. That's a parent's job, it's a teacher's job, it's a grandparent's job. So I'm not against, I love entertainment, I love TV, I love movies, I love these things, but the fact is they cannot become a substitute, not just for reading, but for life. And I worry that we're raising a generation of kids who are more comfortable dealing with electronic devices than they are the world and humanity.
Catherine Cabin is from Birmingham, Alabama. I know a woman who is a prison guard, and she said that the one thing that all those women had in common were that they could not read. I just wondered if you had found that in any of your surveys.
No truer words, alas, were ever spoken. If you look at the literacy levels or the reading skills among people who are incarcerated, they are vastly worse than society in general. And you think about this, it's very commonsensical. If you're a kid and you're not, somehow you don't find that productive means of socialization in adolescence, you're gonna do less well in school. If you can't read, every grade it becomes harder. And you misbehave, you act out, or you just stop showing up. And so, if you look at this, illiteracy and low reading skills are universal problems in prisons. We are, in fact, developing a special version of the big read for juvenile detention centers. I don't think we'll ever have it big enough to deal with the magnitude of the problem, but we want to once again provide an example of the kind of programs we need to have if there's going to be any chance at all in a sense of rehabilitating these people and bringing them back into society. Because, you can't take a kid, and these are kids in some cases, who, really can't even perform at a seventh grade level, throw them in jail for 10 years, and expect them to come out and be a productive citizen. It just won't happen. They're going to end up in jail again.
This is not an either-or question, but how do you compare the need for this and congressional reaction response to the need for arts education in the elementary schools?
They're one and the same thing. The United States has had a vast negative change over the last 30, 40 years. I mean, I'm 56 years old, and I'm old enough to remember a time when every public school in the United States had a band, may have had a jazz band, a choir, a theater program, some kind of writing thing of the school paper, a school literary magazine, might even had dance as part of physical education and studio art. These were just taken for granted as part of public education. These things have been systematically dismantled by local school boards, by county boards, by state groups, and in a way in which now, generally, the availability of arts education in public schools is a function of the community's income. It's available to affluent kids, but generally not anywhere else. I mean, I'll give you an anecdote which illustrates this. Just after I became chairman, I was in Washington, D.C., John Philip Sousa High School was celebrating one of the centenaries of Sousa. But they didn't have a band, they didn't have a choir, so they played a record. This is a school named after a great American composer and bandmaster, and they don't even have a band. It's a poor school. It's a poor black school. And what happens, and this is the thing that I think is really important, and I don't want to belabor this, but if you think of a kid, they're 14 years old, they're kind of entering adolescence, they're breaking away from their parents, which is part of maturity, and they know they're going to be a slightly different kid than their parents want them to be, but they don't really know what that is yet. And they look for guidance from other kids and from other adult role models, which basically means the school and their fellow students. Most schools, you can be a nerd or a jock. You can be an academic kid or you can be an athlete, and those are the two kind of forms of socialization. But most kids don't fit into one of those categories. And if you have, suddenly you've got a kid feels kind of alienated, tries out for play, goes there, and meets a bunch of other alienated kids. And they, first of all, they say, gee, I'm not the only one that feels this way. And then they say, well, maybe we really aren't weird. Maybe we're just a different kind of kid. They develop individual skills, speaking clearly, maybe designing sets, acting, and things like this. They develop social skills. They're working with a company of people. They become very good friends with these people. Then they put the performance on, doing what they actually do best, and they receive applause from their own community, recognition from their fellow students. It's transformational, both in terms of the individual merit and in terms of their social skills. You know, I was, you know, raised in a really rough neighborhood, doing mostly music. And I assure you, from my observation of my high school, there's almost no difference between great musicians and the criminal class. It's just that these kids take all of their, you know, this kind of competitive, acting out, aggressive thing, and they when they put them in together in an instrument and learn the drums or the trumpet or whatever, they channel that, and it becomes a positive social force, a positive individual expression versus a negative or destructive one. And it teaches them how to discipline themselves, how to learn something, how to master something. That sort of daily cumulative mastery of a challenging skill is an irreplaceable thing for someone to learn. And then they also learn social skills. You take these out of a public school system or a private school system, suddenly you've closed all of these doors to social success, to self-realization, to academic belonging. And we live in a society in which 70% of the kids graduate high school. The other 30 drop out. One of the reasons they're dropping out is because we don't give them many pathways to success. We really only give them a few. Woody Allen once said something that I thought was brilliant. I didn't realize it was brilliant the first time he said it. 90% of success is showing up. I thought that was silly when I first heard it as a teenager, but I assure you, as an adult, 90% of success is showing up. And kids that show up for school are more likely to graduate than those kids who don't. And we know that high schools that put arts programs in have higher rates of attendance universally. So, you know, on a very simple scale, I mean, I think it's absolutely, and the reading and arts education are one and the same thing. It's about it's not about producing artists, it's about producing complete human beings who are productive in a free society.
I'm Bob Kleinman from Aspen, Colorado. I'm a performing arts educator and historian. When I was at school, we used to have to write book reports. Now, is there any possibility of a competition, either at a local, state, or national level, or all three, of a competition of these people writing book reports to induce them to read more?
It's an interesting idea. It never occurred to me, but that would, you know, it's an interesting idea. We've created a national competition for poetry recitation. We've done this with the Poetry Foundation of Chicago. We have nearly 200,000 high school kids who compete in this. And they have to memorize a poem first at a classroom level, then a school level. And every level that they go up, they have to memorize more poems, town level, region level, state finals. Then we have a national competition. The kids love it. And the other interesting thing, when you look at the 51 finalists, the 50 states and the District of Columbia, it's like a World War II bomber movie. Every type of American is represented in these finals. And I'd say about half the kids are first-generation Americans. And so it's a wonderful kind of program because they learn this mastery of language. They learn an ability to speak comfortably in public, to compete, as well as just immersing themselves in literature and literary language. And I think the more competitions like this, because anything you do in competition, Americans like better. Think of American Idol. Who would listen to these people sing under any other circumstances? But, you know, you start making competition, it adds a kind of an excitement to it. So I wish we could do this for every art form.
I'm Audrey Greenberg from Los Angeles. You spoke of your mother quoting poetry to you, reading. In other words, a parent from an early age can assist a child. I'm thinking of a city like Los Angeles that I think has 35 languages being spoken for little ones coming home. When they come home from school, the parents do not help them with their homework. are not even there probably, but are not dealing with the many, many languages, and they keep their own at home. Does this permanently keep children at a young age all the way through who are not able to read as fluently as other children of their age group that are learning English as
Let me ask you a question. Did your father speak English as a native language?
Yes.
Okay. My father did not. And how many people in this room were raised by, at least had one parent who was spoke a different language? Is it at least a couple people here? You know, and I think it's a very common part of America is that people are, you know, they come in from other countries and they're raised, you know, essentially with more than one language, sometimes three languages. So if you look at this, I think we have to look at that while we have many languages, English is the meeting place. And, but, you know, my dad didn't speak English till he was dropped off in kindergarten. And it's just, you know, it makes it more difficult. But I don't think that that's, you know, all you can recognize is that there's a slightly steeper slope. And the schools and the community, you know, have to essentially assimilate them. But the media is so powerful in doing this. I think it's very unlikely that, you know, a kid is not going to have the television and radio and internet and everything else doing it. The question is, when most of the English language instruction consists of people trying to sell you things, it's not as good as having it happen in school, having it happen in other spaces and culture. And I worry about being a country in which increasingly every inch of space has been commercialized, even now in the schools. So I acknowledge the issue, but I think it makes language instruction and language facility all the more important because it's one of the few things that we all have in common is that English is the meeting place of America. I mean, whatever other languages you speak at home, this is the meeting place. Where's the... it's a question of our wandering microphonist here. Yeah.
And I was just in a bookstore, and there are these books that says there are 100, 500 places you should visit before you die. Now, if you have such a thing, 100, 500 books you should read before you die.
Well, I can list 105 books you should read right off the top of my head. You know, I think that, you know, the interesting thing is that most people, and this is actually part of the thing about the big read, is that most people want to read because somebody they like has read a book and likes it, and not only does it have kind of a literary importance, that's sort of a you know, an intimate personal importance because, you know, you sort of read the books that are important to your friends, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I would recommend starting with the first 12 titles of the big read. I mean, you can't do better than that list. But everybody has their favorite books, you know, so, and there's a number of 100 best lists. What I've discovered as a kind of collector of 100 best lists, when you ask people to make a list of great, of, you know, 100 best books, it tends to bring out the pretentious in everyone. So I'd like to, you know, have them list their 10 books and say, what are 10 books you would have liked to put on that list but you were embarrassed to? And then you get some really interesting choices. I mean, books that, you know, that that actually people read out of sheer guilty pleasure. And I think sheer guilty pleasure is not a bad place, you know, to start reading. I mean, most people, it's interesting, most people I know that are really lifelong readers read serious books, and they also read junk. And the two have a kind of a wonderful symbiotic relationship with each other. So they read mysteries, they read thrillers, they read science fiction, they read westerns. So I think what you should do is have somebody write down a book that they love, but they would be embarrassed to say in public. And you'll get some good choices. What's your favorite book, by the way? What's your favorite book? Yeah, no, My Antonia is a great book. I'll tell you a book here that I just reread because we were doing the show on it, and I think there's some CDs left. If you've never read The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton, it is so good. I mean, it is just a page-turner. And, you know, I'd read it a long time ago, then I saw the Martin Scorsese film of it, but I'd first forgotten how good the book is.
Thank you.
No, that's very, very true. But I'll tell you something that's scary. The level of complete illiteracy in the country hasn't really gone up. You know, what's gone up are people who have actually completed a certain amount of education and are still unable to read at a decent level. This kind of very low level literacy. In fact, we're producing the first generation of college graduates who don't read after graduation, or who in some cases can't read very well. And so there is, you know, this is a problem that really goes from the bottom of society on up. And when you get into a very poor community with really high levels of endemic illiteracy, it's almost insolvable unless you have a massive intervention. And it probably has to be done largely with things like church groups as well as governmental groups, because no single group has the resources to do it. Do we have any more questions, or have we tired you out? Okay. Well, let's end with a poem. You know, they can cut it off the radio. I mean, they don't want to shock their listeners. This is a little snippet of Shakespeare. I was thinking, we're doing a program tomorrow on William Shakespeare and W.H. Auden, the wonderful British poet who died an American citizen, whose centenary we're celebrating this year. But when I'm in a place like Aspen and I've left Washington, a speech that I'm reminded of is the one from As You Like It. And if you remember, the Duke, his brother, has seized the kingdom, and he's now living in the Forest of Arden in exile. And the Forest of Arden is kind of cold, a little bit rough, and some of the people in his camp wanted to make peace so they can go back to the court. And this is the advice that he gives them. "Now, my co-mates and brothers in exile, hath not old custom made this life more sweet than that of painted pomp? Are not these woods more free from peril than the envious court? Here feel we but the penalty of Adam, the season's difference, as when the icy fang and churlish chiding of the winter wind, which when it bites and blows upon my body, even till I shrink with cold, I smile and say, here is no flattery. These are counselors who feelingly persuade me what I am. Sweet are the uses of adversity, and this, our life, exempt from public haunt, finds tongues in trees, books in running brooks, sermons in stones, and good in everything." Thank you very much. Thank you.